stand with me if you would please, and let's read Genesis chapter 37, verses 18, 19, and 20. And when they, Joseph's brothers, saw him, Joseph, afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired, there's that word, conspiracy. They conspired against him to slay him, his own brothers. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. You may be seated. Before the word of God was completed, the Lord often appeared to his servants in dreams. Abimelech was communicated to by God in a dream, warning him against touching Sarah, Abraham's wife. That's in Genesis chapter 20. In the book of Genesis, I did a quick count and I found some 20 references to God revealing himself to Joseph in dreams. In Numbers chapter 12 and verse 6, and he said, hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision and will speak unto him in a dream. Gideon overheard the dream of an enemy and knew that the dream was of God and meant for him in Judges chapter 7. In 1 Kings chapter 3, Solomon was spoken to by God in a dream. And of course, we're all familiar with the dreams of Daniel. And in the New Testament, Joseph, the husband of Mary, was approached three times by an angel in a dream. The first time, when he was told that it was okay to wed Mary as his wife. The second time, he was instructed to flee Bethlehem and go to Egypt. And the third time, he was instructed to return to Israel after the death of Herod. All these were in dreams. Of course, the Bible also was very careful to tell his people to be aware of false dreams. In Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 32, behold, I am against them that prophesy false dreams, saith the Lord, and do tell them, and cause my people to err by their lies and by their lightness. Yet I sent them not, nor commanded them. Therefore they shall not profit this people at all, saith the Lord. Zechariah 10, 2, for the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and have told false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore they went their way as a flock. They were troubled because there was no shepherd. So God obviously warned against those who would deliver false visions and false dreams to the people. By the way, you know, if you read the Old Testament, you'll find that any man that called himself a prophet and claimed that he was giving a vision that God had given him, and the vision or the dream did not come true, what did God tell the people of Israel to do to that man? Stone him to death. Now in Genesis chapter 37, verses 19 and 20, the text that we just read a moment ago, I want you to see it again. And they said one to another, behold, this, what? Dreamer cometh. This dreamer cometh. Ladies and gentlemen, it cannot be overemphasized the importance of having a dream. I checked some of my notes and I found some of the quotes that I had penned from others relative to this topic. One of my favorites was spoken by someone that I did not really care for politically, but I love this quotation. "There are those who look at things the way they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not." Who said that? Robert Kennedy. Thomas Jefferson said, "I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past." Carl Sandburg, the historian, said, "Nothing happens unless first a dream." William Shakespeare wrote in The Tempest, something you probably are familiar with, though you may not have known where it came from, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of." And we don't know who said this. "The poorest man is not without a cent, but without a dream." And this is one of my favorites. Walt Disney. Walt Disney said, "If you can dream it, you can do it. Always remember, this whole thing was started by a mouse." "Behold, this dreamer cometh." I've always kind of been a dreamer. Even when I was a kid, I know you're going to find this hard to believe, some of you. I was a romantic. Still am. My first romance was in third grade. I fell in love with my teacher. You know, I guess you shouldn't say that these days. I was in the third grade, and her name was Miss Sour. I'm here to tell you, though, guys, she was not sour. She was sweet. That was the only school year I ever attended that I hated to see come to an end. Boy, she was beautiful. I would get in trouble just on purpose, just so I could stay after class. And then that seemed to set a pattern for the rest of my life. And then in the fifth grade, there was Karis Kessler. Oh, what a beauty she was. She didn't even look at me. Her and her best friend, Karen Williams, were the two most popular kids in school, and they were both stuck-up snobs. And they got straight A's, and they were the teacher's pets, but I couldn't help it. I was crazy about Karis. And then in the seventh grade, my first real kiss with Cheryl Johnson in the upstairs church lobby of the Baptist Missionary Church at 812 Monroe Street in LaPorte, Indiana. Wow. And then when I was a kid, going to the movies and the big screen, oh, I fell in love with Juliet. And I fell in love with Snow White. The one that was in Snow White and the Three Stooges. You ever see that one? She was so pretty. And then, of course, there came Natalie Wood. And my heart just sank. And for all of you people that are watching now and probably starting to blog, he's talking about Hollywood again. I got to tell you, I love, and I unapologetically, I love a good movie. I don't care what anybody says. I love a good movie, especially the ones that are based on real life events and the ones that are told with a heart and with some passion and with soul and spirit. I love them. They inspire me, and they always have. Believe it or not, and again, I know some of you are going to find this really hard to believe, I can even write poetry. When we start out life depending upon our nature and our upbringing and our heart, we have our dreams. Sometimes our dreams are attainable, sometimes they are not, but we always have a dream. But as we get older, as we grow into adulthood, we find the world is filled with dream killers. Joseph's brothers were dream killers. Behold, this dreamer cometh. What did they have against Joseph? Why did they hate him so much? Why did they hate him so much they wanted to kill him? Their own flesh and blood. Because of his dreams. They hated his dreams. Now you and I both know that God was providential in the life of Joseph. Can I get an amen to that? Take your Bibles and turn real quickly to Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20. He's now the vice regent in Egypt. You know the story. The family and the Israelites now have found shelter and safety in Egypt from the famine that was upon the land. Had Joseph not been in Egypt as a slave, he never would have been the vice regent of Egypt. He never would have been in a position to save God's people. It was all providential. Verse 20, but as for you, you dream killers, you brothers who hated me, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it to good, to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. You wanted to kill me, but God had a purpose and a plan for you putting me in the pit and selling me as a slave to the Ishmaelites and being taken as a prisoner to Egypt. And the false accusation against him by Potiphar's wife, who accused him of trying to rape her, landing him in prison, which means he came in contact with the baker and the butler, and the whole story of how finally one of them remembered him as an interpreter of dreams whenever the Pharaoh had a dream. And, oh yes, I remember there was a prisoner named Joseph who could interpret dreams and bring him before me. And the next thing you know, Joseph is the vice regent of the greatest and most powerful and wealthy nation in the world at that time. The dream killers. In one of my favorite movies, First Night, King Arthur says to Queen Guinevere, only a fool dreams for what he cannot have. In that case, my friends, I am a fool. For I have a dream I cannot have. How about you? How many dreams have been killed by a wife? Or by a husband, or by a brother, or a sister, or a friend, or maybe by circumstances, or maybe by fate, or by time. But the dream killer has arisen and has destroyed the dream that the young man or the young woman had. or the old man and the old woman. I've had a throat problem this week. That's why I happened to go to the well a few more times than usual. I was raised an only child. Now you know what's wrong with me. I have two half-sisters. Same father, different mother. Both of my sisters are old enough to be my parents. They were both in their 20s when I was born. My mother was 40, my dad was 45 when I was born. My mother was never supposed to have children. The doctors told her she had a medical condition and she would never have a child. But at the age of 40, she had me. My parents were old enough to be my grandparents. And I was raised in a siblingless house. Being without brother or sister at home, born to aged parents, raised an only child, the one word that probably best describes, even though it was a very happy childhood and a very normal childhood, I mean, no abuse, no, thank God, no neglect, all these problems that we hear so many of these kids having to deal with today. I thank God I never had that. My parents loved me. They took good care of me, and I was raised in a Christian home. But the word, the operative word of my life when I was a child was probably been lonely. Every time Mom and Dad got together with friends, all of their friends were always dinosaurs. I don't know how else to describe it. I swore when I was a kid and I would go, you know, I would be drug along to visit with all these friends of my parents, I would have sworn they all came over on the Mayflower. That they were old. And I don't know what it was, you know, they never had any kids because, you know, their kids were already grown and gone. And so there I am sitting in the midst of a bunch of old fuddy-duddies. 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, bored out of my gourd. But looking back, I got to make this caveat statement. Looking back on it after I became a man and God led me the way he led me to do what I'm doing, I realize now that there was a great purpose in all that, because the people that I was around as a child of the older generation connected me to a past that so many in my generation and younger have been totally disconnected from. And even though at the time I was bored and at the time I didn't care, the stories I heard, the lessons I heard, the insight, the wisdom, the history of that generation, I mean, we're talking about, now think about it, my grandfather, here we are in 2011, my grandfather was born in 1880. I heard the stories of not just the Depression and World War I and World War II, but I heard the stories of pre-20th century. The stories I heard go back to the buckboard wagons and the 19th century. And I could stand here for hours and give you personal stories of what my family experienced and so was passed down to me through those word of mouth stories that I heard growing up as a child. At the time, however, it seemed to be such a lonely existence. And then as soon as I was married, I entered the gospel ministry. I was married at the age of 21. At the age of 23, I was pastoring a local New Testament church, 23 years of age. I remember I would go knocking on doors, inviting people to church, and I would introduce myself, and I would say, "Hello, I'm Chuck Baldwin, I'm pastor of," and they would say, "Yeah, and I'm George Washington, the father of my country. Yeah, I'm Henry VIII. It was probably the better part of 10 years pastoring before I wasn't the youngest member of my congregation. One of the responsibilities of a true shepherd, it is a responsibility that is sacred in both heaven and earth. The honor of it, the ethics of it, require absolute, total silence. One of the things that I believe that a lot of my brethren are going to give a terrible account of to God when they stand before the judgment seat of Christ is their inability to keep their mouth shut about things they should not speak of. And all over America, I know of pastors who will go home and share with their wives, for example, what they heard in confidence that day. And the wife will share it with the deacon's wife. He will share it with some other member of the church. And before next Sunday rolls around, three-fourths of the congregation know what was discussed in the private chambers of that pastor's study. Brothers and sisters, that is a sin and a crime against heaven and against man. There are certain things that are sacred. And the relationship between a pastor and his congregation is one of them. In my opinion, it is more sacred than the relationship between a physician and his patients, or between an attorney and his clients. And I think I've already told you the story how that one time in a murder investigation, I had FBI agents and U.S. Marshals in my office demanding that I tell them something that was said in a private counseling session with the person that they were investigating for this terrible crime. And I looked those federal officers in the eye and I told them, it's not because I don't want to help you, it's not because I would try to ever hinder or impede a lawful investigation, nothing of the sort, but you do understand that everything that's said in that office between that person and me is confidential, and beyond that, it's sacred. And you can put me in jail, you can put handcuffs on me, you can do whatever you want. I will tell you nothing. That is a sacred, sacred conversation. All through the ministry, I honored that sacredness, that code of silence. And if I was ever uncertain as to where the line was, I always erred on the side of silence rather than to make a mistake. It was amazing after everything that happened. And we came here, and all of the attacks that came against us, and the lies and the utter contempt and hatred and hostility that was levied against me and my family when we decided to make the move to Montana. That's amazing. I'm still carrying with me today personal information about many of the people that have said these terrible, awful, wicked things about me. And I'm still carrying things that I've learned in private when I was their pastor. And to this day, not one single member of my family knows anything about those things. And I've never shared them with anyone, and never will. They will go to the grave with me. As I got into the work that God had called me to, I was traveling a lot. I was going across America speaking. I even was going overseas quite often back in those days. And all that was done mostly alone. And for those of you that would look at the pastorate and the ministry as being some kind of a glorified position, I will tell you that, like so many of you, I have been forsaken by most everyone who ever called themselves a friend. Only a handful have been faithful in that relationship. 99% of them forsook that what should have been sacred friendship. I came to Montana. I say all that. Believe me, I'm headed somewhere. This is not rambling. I came to Montana with no personal aspirations. None. If I know my heart at all, and I know the heart can be deceitful and wicked, but if I know my heart at all, there are no personal aspirations. God emptied everything out of me. From the time we left Florida to the time that we arrived in Montana, if there was anything left in personal ambition, if there was anything left in personal aspiration, they were truly destroyed. My dreams have already been drowned in the sea of hostility and betrayal. Since I've come to Montana, many people have urged me to run for governor of this great state. I want to tell you this right now. If I ever make a decision to run for any public office in this state, it will not be because of any personal ambition. None whatsoever. The dream would have nothing to do with Chuck Baldwin, but it would have everything to do with the dream for a state living under the principles of liberty. I know that if I became a gubernatorial candidate, and if our campaign gained traction and momentum, and I believe it would, and just to let you know, I believe that I could raise enough money to make it a very viable, competitive race. I really believe that. I also know that if that happened, if I became a gubernatorial candidate, and if we were able to raise the money that we needed to be competitive, and if we got traction, and if we were able to gain momentum in this race for 2012, and I'm not just saying this to sound dramatic, I know that that decision could very easily cost me my life. And if you think I'm just saying that to be dramatic, you don't have a clue what's going on. It could cost me my life. And I know that. So please spare me, those of you who would accuse me of deciding to seek public office for personal aggrandizement or personal ambition. Excuse me. You don't know what you're talking about. If that happened, I would die with an unfulfilled dream. Would I then have died a fool? That's what Arthur said. I don't think so. Because the really noble dreams, are not about self. They are about others. Joseph's dreams were not about him. Even though he was in the dreams and he was part of the dreams were not about him. They were about his family, and they were about his country. They were about the ones he loved. Famine, and by the way, this is not, I'm not heading toward an announcement of any kind. So relax. I'm not heading that way. The dreams were not about him, and they were not about his goals and his ambitions. They were about his family. They were about his country. They were about the ones he loved. Famine and destitution were coming to his people. He saw this. God showed him his land was about to be devoured by famine and pestilence and dearth. He dreamed of their protection and of their deliverance. God gave him a dream of how his people could be delivered from the impending famine that was just around the corner. I ask you, are these not the best of dreams? Are the best of dreams, the dreams that are dreamed for others, are the best of dreams, the dreams that are dreamed for our country, for our God, for our children, and not for ourselves? Am I right? Or am I wrong? If I die today, I have an unfulfilled dream. So be it. The dreams that are important are the dreams that we dream for others. Now I want you to listen carefully. Who could Joseph talk to about his dreams? He talked to his brothers about his dreams, and what happened? They became insanely jealous. They sought his death. They wanted to kill him. I'm sure they laughed at him. I'm sure they ridiculed him. I'm sure they looked at him with that same look that we have all seen in the eyes of some of our families and some of our friends, that deer in the headlights stare of what in the world are you talking about? Amen. So now he's a slave in Egypt. Who does he tell his dreams to now? Who cares about the dreams of a slave? Who would listen? Who would understand or empathize with him? He was, after all, a slave. Likewise, who do we, the remnant of Liberty Fellowship, share our dreams for freedom and liberty with? The dreams that we have collectively in this room, and the dreams of many that are watching over the internet right now, are watching this video later. The dreams that we have are not about selfish prosperity. They're not about building a name for ourselves. It's not about personal success. The dream that brings us to Liberty Fellowship, the dream that is bringing people to the Flathead Valley from all over America, is the dream of liberty. In fact, most of us are here at some sort of a financial sacrifice. How many people come to Montana to get rich that you know of? Most of us came here by faith. We came here, many of us, not knowing if we were going to be able to earn a living after we got here. Many of us not knowing where we were going to sleep at night. There are still some in this audience that do not have a permanent place to put their head on a pillow at night. Many of us have endured the suffering and the pain and the agony of having our best friends, our loved ones, our family members that were dear to us, ridicule us, laugh at us, impugn our character, impugn our rationality, accusing us sometimes of losing it, or joining a Chuck Baldwin's cult. You ever heard that? And yet we came, and we're coming. Why? Because of a dream for wealth, a dream for success, a personal dream of pleasure, or whatever it might be? No. It's a dream for freedom. It's a dream for liberty. It's a dream that there can be a state somewhere within these states united that at some point, at some time, will be able to stand and rise, as Jefferson said, as free and independent states and reclaim that birthright that we as Americans have been given by God for our children. It's not about Chuck Baldwin, and it's not about you. The dream is as was Joseph's. The dream was for others. The dream was for his family, his posterity, his nation. Now, I am not a prophet, and God did not speak to me in a dream to say what I'm about to say. So don't stone me if it doesn't happen. But I'm a student of history. And anybody who has studied history to any degree, you don't have to have a PhD to figure this out. You know that our country, and yea, the world, as was Joseph's country in his day, is on the precipice of great cataclysm. One would have to be a moron to not see it coming. All of the people in the know, the PTBs, powers that be, the movers and shakers in government, in commerce, politics, they all know it's coming. I have had federal officers tell me that they are personally preparing for great cataclysm. FBI people, CIA people, federal marshals, people that are in the Pentagon, people that are at the White House, people that work out of Washington, D.C., and they are nervous. And many of them are making personal preparations for their own families because of what they see coming. What the current and past crops of politicians and bankers and financiers have done and are doing to America is nothing short of criminal. And they know exactly what they're doing. And I hate to burst your bubble. All you people that have this R&D mentality, and if you keep coming to Liberty Fellowship, I'm going to do everything I can to get you out of that R&D mentality. Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, they have all been in collusion over the last several decades to bring us where we are today. And if you think for 1 minute that the Republicans in Congress are going to stop raising the debt ceiling, you don't know what's going on. They are never going to do that. They will allow the debt ceiling to be raised. Count on it. Because quite frankly, they don't care about the country. What they care about is the 2012 election. And neither the R's or the D's, the donkeys or the elephants, want to be blamed for shutting down the government. And so they're going to raise it, just like they've always raised it. And they'll keep raising it. And they'll keep raising it. Nobody's going to stop it. The R's are not going to stop it. The D's are not going to stop it. It's going to continue. We are $14 trillion in debt. What does that mean to you and me? $14 trillion. And when you hear them talk about debt reduction, please understand you are being had by verbal duplicity. There is no debt reduction. When they talk about reduction, they're not talking about cuts, or they talk about cutting the deficit. They're not cutting anything. When they talk about cuts, what they're talking about is cuts to the increases. In other words, it's not going to increase as much as it would have. Now, can you get by with that when you talk about your personal budget? When you talk about cuts to your budget, you're talking about spending less. That's not what it means in Washington, D.C. Cuts means we're still spending more, but not as much as we would have without the cuts. That's what they mean by debt reduction. The debt is going up somewhere between 500 trillion, 500 billion to $1 trillion every year, and it will continue to do that. And nothing is going to stop it. What does that mean? It means that in the next 10 years, we are going to go from a $14 trillion debt to somewhere between a $25 and $28 trillion debt. And it's not going to matter who's elected president in 2012 unless it's Ron Paul. He's the only one that would make a difference. None of the others are going to make a difference. Now, just think logically with me for a minute. The only way that the government can maintain a sense of normalcy among the citizenry during this period of intense indebtedness is going to practically double in the next 10 years, which means the value of your dollar continues to depreciate, and everything is, of course, connected to the dollar. The only way they can do that and keep the country halfway afloat, because they're not going to reduce the debt, they don't have the character to do it. There are politicians looking for election, and too many Americans have their hands out to the government and don't want them to cut. The only way they can do it is just to keep printing and printing and printing and printing and printing more fiat currency out of thin air. And they will continue to do that. You watch in the next few months or weeks even, there's going to be another round of bailouts to the bankers. It's coming. They're already talking about it. Bernanke's talking about it. It's coming. So they keep printing and they keep printing and they keep printing and they keep printing, and the debt just goes up and up and up and up. And now 10 years, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, we're $25, $26, $28 trillion in debt. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't have to be very bright, but I ask you the question, think about it. Is that sustainable? It is not. It is not. There is no formula that has ever been devised in the history of man that can solve a debt problem like that. Which means there is only one solution. And the powers that be know it, and they're already working toward it behind the scenes in the international dealings of the CIA and our U.S. foreign policy is already in the process of bringing this to a boiling point. I'm telling you, in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be all-out major war. Because that's the only thing that can bring a nation out of that kind of indebtedness. You have a major war, and you start over. You erase the debt and you start over. Except this time, we're talking about nuclear war. I don't think you have to be a prophet. I don't think you have to have a dream or a vision in the night to recognize that we are on a collision course with nuclear war. There is no doubt about it. And out of the dust of that war will come a new world order. And the America that we knew as a sovereign, independent nation will cease to exist. and the global union of sorts will evolve. Complete with a new currency, a new economic system, a new government structure. It'll be a brand new world. It's inevitable. Joseph saw in his dream the impending calamity on his country. He shared his dream with his brothers, and they hated him for it. They sold him into slavery. God used it to allow Joseph to be in a position to become of a great benefit and help to the people that he loved so dearly. You and I are brought to this place with a dream, with a vision. Not for personal gain, but a dream of freedom for our children. And if we do not share the principles of liberty, if we do not share the dream with the people of this state in which we live, to the point that when this cataclysm occurs, there will still be enough God-fearing, can I use that word? God-fearing, liberty-loving, don't tread on me, I will live free or die kind of people to keep this land free. There has to be a place for the remnant. There has to be a place where free people can still live free. In the result and the dust and the shattered prosperity that is to come, there must arise a Joseph. There must arise a land. There must arise a people. There must arise, call it what you will, a fellowship. There must arise a dream. A dream of liberty. That's why God led us to this place. That's why we're here. We're not here for personal ambition. I may or may not run for public office. That's not why we're here. We came to be with people who share the love and the understanding for the principles of liberty, and who are willing to fight and die to defend and protect them. And we believe we are in the right place. And you in this fellowship have affirmed that decision. It does not necessarily give me pleasure to say this, but in the 5 to 6 months that this fellowship has been in existence, we have already more of a unity and appreciation and understanding and vision and love for these principles than I have seen in my entire 35-year pastoral ministry. In 5 or 6 months. Don't let anything fool you. I'm trying to say, those of you that have tended to give up your dream, You come here pessimistic. You come here maybe even fatalistic. You come here saying, there is no hope. There's nothing we can do. And listen, there are Montanans, our brothers, all over the Flathead Valley who have given up because they don't believe that anything can be done to turn it around. And you know what? They might be right. There might be nothing that can be done to turn it around. But I tell you what, there can be something done after God does whatever God is going to do. He can still raise up a people, listen, with a dream. Remember what Patrick Henry said? I told you earlier what Patrick Henry said, and I'm paraphrasing it. Before the tyrant can put the chain around your neck, he must put it first around your heart. And as long as those chains never go around our hearts, they'll never go around our necks, because we will die first. Listen, this commitment requires two things. It requires, number one, vision, and number two, it requires love. Proverbs 29:18, where there is no vision, the people perish. John 13:35, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. Joseph had both a vision for his people and a love for his people. A dream, a real dream. Not a whim. A real dream requires both vision and love. On the whole today, Christians and churches have neither vision nor love. They cannot see outside the box. They cannot see anything besides R&D. They cannot see beyond the four walls of their own ministry. They refuse to see the signs of the times or the scriptural principles relating to them. And they show very little genuine love and fellowship. Listen to the gossip, the slander, the backbiting. See the spirit of hatred, envy, and selfishness that permeates the average church in America today. We don't have to worry about the enemy killing us. We devour ourselves. And the same is true with our political candidates and office holders. Where is the vision for the principles of liberty, constitutionalism, independence, and state autonomy? Where is the love for our posterity that's going to inherit the mess that we create for them? Where is the love for the preservation of a decent, safe, and prosperous country in which our children and grandchildren might grow up? How can these politicians, Republican and Democrat alike, how can they treat these elections as if it's just more of the same? The same old rhetoric, the same old dinners, the same old cliches, the same old campaign strategies. It's the same old, same old, same old. Let me tell you what, the same old got us into this mess, and the same old is going to keep us in this mess. Where's the passion? Where is the vision? Where is the ability to articulate the message of truth and freedom so that people can understand it, become energized, so they can see a dream? You listen to the average politician, listen to most of the politicians, you don't see a dream. You go to sleep. It's the same old thing. My dear friends, I hope when you see me coming afar off, you can say what Joseph's brother said about him: behold, this dreamer cometh. Because I want to share my dream with you at Liberty Fellowship. Not a dream of personal ambition, but a dream of freedom and liberty for our children. I want to share my dream of a people free from tyranny above them and hatred and animus between them. Liberty Fellowship, if we are true dreamers, if the dream of liberty truly burns in our heart, the vision, of course, is necessary, but so is the love. That means we have to love one another. I don't mean just talking about it. We have to love one another. A true fellowship is a fellowship of love. A fellowship of respect. A fellowship of trust. Now mark it down. The devil will plant those among us who do not share our love or our vision. They are the tares amongst the wheat. And they will come in amongst us to spy out our liberty, to try and create confusion and discord, disharmony. Because the greatest threat that we have always faced has always been from within, not from without. So I caution you to be alert. But at the same time, to never, never lose your vision or your love for one another. Your love for what this fellowship and this message is all about. In Acts chapter 2, verse 17, I'll wrap this up in a moment. And it shall come to pass on the last day, saith God, I'll pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. And your old men shall dream dreams. Maybe that's why I dream. I'm old. I'm old enough to remember a little of what freedom in America was like before the politicians from both parties turned our country into a burgeoning police state. I remember when we felt patriotic by bringing our troops home from war, not by sending them all over the world to make war. I remember when people were truly more interested in asking what they could do for their country, not by asking what their country could do for them. I remember when the dollar was the envy of the world, when the U.S. flag was respected by all the nations of the world, including the Muslim nations, when school children were free to pray and read their Bibles in school, when one could take a handgun on an airliner and no one thought anything about it, when we didn't have sexual molesters posing as government security screeners at airports, and when children could ride their bicycles all over town alone without the faintest thought of being unsafe. Liberty Fellowship, we need to dream this dream again. We must have a vision again. We must have love again. We must be positioned providentially by God so that when the calamity comes and the aftermath takes effect, there are men and women in this place that have never and will never lose their dream. Let it be said of each of us at Liberty Fellowship, and those of you that are watching, that are here in spirit, let it be said of each of us, when people see us afar off, behold, this dreamer. cometh. Stand, please.